This is an ABC podcast.
I want you to imagine you are an autistic child. You are sitting in the corner of your room, facing the wall, and you are alone.
Hello, I'm Rebecca Huntley, and welcome to the History Listen.
And gradually your whole being is centered.
What you're hearing is a 1969 segment from ABC TV's current affairs show, This Day Tonight, claiming to tell the story from a child's point of view. It was one of the very first explorations in Australia of what it meant to be autistic.
And you have known fear on a scale not experienced by normal human beings. But then you are not a normal human being.
Although the assumptions made in the segment make us cringe today, it was groundbreaking at the time. In 1960s Australia, very few people had even heard of the term autism, and the diagnosis itself had only been in medical literature for just over 20 years. Over the next 2 weeks on The History Listen, producer Kathy Pryor, a parent of two autistic boys herself, delves deep into the archives to explore the evolution of ideas about autism in Australia. Here's part one of The Singular Mind.
No one knows what causes autism, and few people know what the word means. For these normal, healthy children, autism simply means they cannot play with their own brothers.
In 1968, a group of Melbourne mothers invited ABC journalist Peter Luck into their homes to talk about a little understood condition called autism.
The psychiatrist have been dodging them for years, and they put me on happy pills.
Dressed in twin sets and pearls, the mothers are the epitome of suburban respectability.
He just couldn't cope with the tantrums that were
playing on swings in the backyard, or sitting at their feet are their school-aged children. But these children are not at school. As their mothers explain, there was no place for them in 1960s Australia.
What do you think is most needed for autistic children in this country?
A centre where they can be taught.
You're all right. My little boy's just given up trying. Before he was interested in letters and writing. Now he's not interested in anything because he doesn't go anywhere.
No.
He's home all day, every day. You're home, darling.
Yes, you're home.
You're all right.
That's Pearl Treweek, whose son Brian was diagnosed with autism when he was 9 years old.
That's me. Oh my God.
Is that you, yes. Ayesha?
Pearl died in 2015, but through a newspaper tribute to her, I've got in touch with her granddaughter, Ayesha Treweek, who spots a little girl in the background of the ABC archives we're watching.
It is, it's me, giving barking orders.
Ayesha came to live with Pearl and her uncle Brian when she was just 12 months old.
So this is in the Women's Weekly in 1967, and that's your nan and Brian. So then he's aged 11. And I think that this might be the first time autism is mentioned in the popular press in Australia. Some of the things she's saying in here are, you know, people don't understand that he's got autism. And so they say, why doesn't she smack him if they see him having a tantrum? And
yeah, why doesn't she smack him? That's so true. There's no point smacking them. Yeah. Brian was good fun. I don't know, he was never treated any different than us. Never, ever. He was expected the same as everybody else, his manners. And he's, of course, non-verbal. But it was just, if Brian has to do something, like, he'd put away the dishes and you'd have to show him exactly how to do it and coach him along and he'd do it. But if he didn't want to, he would flat out refuse to do anything. And then would say, Brian! And off he'd go again, hoot and holler, and off he'd go down the road, go to the milk bar and demand lollies from them. I thought, oh, my God, he's good. And they said, it's him. Who does he belong to? I go, me. It's my uncle. And they said, it's him that comes in every day. He screams and bangs and screams, and they give him lollies. And off he goes. It was so funny. They were petrified.
Brian left a school for autistic children 7 years ago. He spent 5 years at home and is now the only autistic person at a sheltered workshop which he attends daily.
They'd go on outings and things like that, but he caused trouble. Like if someone was sat on his seat in the bus, he would literally drag them off. I remember one day he came home with the biggest black eye I've ever seen in my life. And I thought, oh my God, what happened? So I went to the bus driver and asked him, and he said, Brian pulled this girl out of the seat. It was his seat. and she wouldn't stand for it, so she bopped him. I thought, oh my God. But he'd sing heaps. And he'd say, Johnny O'Keefe, to Nan, Johnny O'Keefe, Johnny O'Keefe. And it was funny. I'd say, is he saying Johnny O'Keefe? And she said, yeah. She'd have the radio all the time on when he was young. And because Brian would hum to it, he'd just hum and sing. He never liked saying, you couldn't hear the words, but he'd hum. I didn't think he was any different than anybody else. But he just needed help. And I loved him, so, and he knew that, I guess.
For parents like Pearl Treweek, the condition their children were diagnosed with was still considered pretty rare. So when did this term autism first arrive in the medical literature? John Donvan is the co-author of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism.
It first appeared at the beginning of the 20th century, but not in the context in which we know it today. It was coined by a Swiss psychiatrist named Eugen Bleuler, who was very fascinated by schizophrenia, and he was trying to clarify what schizophrenia was about in the definition. And he noticed that some people with schizophrenia, in addition to symptoms like hallucinations, which are kind of classic, also sometimes fell into a sort of non-engagement with people around them. They kind of just withdrew into themselves. And it was that idea of in themselves that inspired Bleuler to say, well, this transitory, this passing behavior of being cut off from social relations, I'm going to call it autism. But about 25 years later, a child psychiatrist from Austria who was living in the States borrowed that term, and over time that became a foundational concept of the way we now know autism today.
This child psychiatrist, whose name was Leo Connor, was intrigued with what he believed was a new condition never before documented in children. In the 1930s, the parents of a young boy called Donald from a small town in Mississippi had come to see him. It was a meeting that would have a profound impact on the history of autism, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Leo Connor was just fascinated by Donald. He said it for the rest of his life that Donald fascinated him because he just wasn't like any kid he had ever seen. Donald had these immense challenges, particularly with language. He was fascinated by numbers and counting and spinning and repetition of things. There were things like the fact that Donald needed things to be the same all the time, that if the furniture was moved in a room, he would have a meltdown. But at the same time, the reason he knew the furniture had been moved is he was demonstrating an amazing memory. And Donald could multiply numbers quickly in his head. And he had a perfect musical pitch. And in fact, when he was 2 years old, his mother sat down at the piano and began singing some Christmas carols. And after one hearing, he walked around the house singing the Christmas carols verbatim.
And children, listen.
Something was going on in his brain that, again, signaled to Connor that this wasn't insanity, and also it wasn't intellectual disability. It was something else. It was some kind of distinctive wiring. And around 1942, this is some 4 years after the first examination, Donald's mother wrote to Leo Connor and said, "You're not telling me what he has. Is he insane?" She said, I have a hopelessly insane child, don't I?" He said, "You don't. I think he's got something that hasn't been described before, and I've now seen several other kids like this." And he published an article, and he described Donald as case number one.
These children belong to that mysterious world of autism. Not 12 years ago, there was not one centre in Australia set up especially for the care and training of children like this.
My name's Dave Earl. I'm a disability historian. I specialise in the history of families with disabled children in 19th and 20th century Australia, particularly since the 1930s, where there was so much talk of eugenics and degeneration and hereditary disease and defects and so on and so forth. There'd been an enormous stigma attached to any sort of intellectual or psychiatric disability. They were actually, in fact, often shunned by neighbours. People talked of walking down the street and seeing curtains being drawn as they walked their child down the street. There was a huge amount of shame.
What effect has this had on you as a person?
Well, sometimes I walk up the street and I'm wondering not only where I'm going, but who I am. And that is really scary.
I had a nervous breakdown myself. I don't say this was the only cause of it, but it contributed in no certain way to the nervous breakdown. And I think half the reason was because at this stage I hadn't been told that he was autistic. And I went on wondering what it was and sort of half blaming myself. Perhaps I'd caused this.
The biggest, most powerful and most damaging theory that persisted for decades was the theory that autism was the result of mothers not loving their children enough. Leo Kanner had some role in getting that idea started when he said that these kids have been put into emotional refrigerators. Other psychiatrists and psychologists took the idea.
There was a theory called refrigerator mothers, which was promoted by Bruno Bettelheim. In 1967, he published a book called The Empty Fortress, and he theorized that what was causing autism was mothers who were treating their children in a disinterested and clinical way.
An example of how deeply this concept penetrated came in 1969. Elvis Presley made his last movie, a film called Change of Habit, in which he played a psychiatrist and his nurse was a nun played by Mary Tyler Moore. And there was all of this sexual tension between the psychiatrist and the nun, which is weird in itself. But there's a scene, a passing scene, where a girl is brought in. Her name is Amanda. She's a young girl, toddler, and she's not speaking. And Mary Tyler Moore says, "I think she's autistic." And Elvis says, "Well, I know what to do about that." And he picks her up and he starts to hug her. And he starts saying to her, "I love you, Amanda, I love you, Amanda, I love you, Amanda." And suddenly, Amanda speaks, and she's cured. She's cured on the spot by a dose of love from the child psychiatrist Elvis Presley. So that's a really good example of how it got into the culture that mothers were at fault for this.
So if you're in the habit of putting people down just because they're different,
many Australians would have seen Elvis in his cinematic swan song, but disability historian Dave Earle says that here, the refrigerator mother theory didn't carry as much weight. Australia was more aligned to the British model of psychiatry, where Freudian psychoanalysis was less popular than it was in the United States. Even so, the stigma travelled far and wide, and this country was not immune. One mother of an autistic child in the 1960s told me how a close friend once accused her of using up all her love on her firstborn son, and there was simply none left for her second child.
We're further ahead than we've ever been with the children, but it's taken since June until about October to get us there.
And if you can't find some sort of satisfactory school at all by next year...
In the 1960s, faced with a sometimes unsympathetic public and schools that habitually excluded their children, parents formed groups to open their own day centres and to agitate for change. Dimphna Essanyi was the president of the first autistic association in this country, which was founded in South Australia in 1964. Her daughter is also called Dimphna, although these days she's known as Deej. Her younger brother was born in 1957.
It became clear fairly shortly after he was one or two that he wasn't talking to us. And he developed some strange behaviours. He didn't like the feeling of food on his hands, so he would get extremely upset. He would only eat standing up at a particular table and wearing several pairs of gloves, one on top of the other. I think there were 7 or 8 or 9 pairs of gloves. I have a very clear memory of my mother coming back from the hospital one day, very disturbed, because she had received a diagnosis for my brother that he had a disorder called childhood schizophrenia.
Deej still has her brother's case notes from the psychiatry clinic at the Adelaide Children's Hospital. By the time her brother was 5, the notes reveal he had received a new diagnosis of infantile autism.
Okay, so in May 1962, case reviewed with Miss Smith, shows more definite picture of infantile autism. The most disturbing aspects of his behaviour are destructiveness, tendency to bite and screaming attacks, also not sleeping well. By the end of the year when he was six, the hospital notes contain consideration of a special school. And he did start at what they used to call in those days an occupation centre. You wouldn't call them schools because there was no sense that the children were being taught anything. They were being occupied. At the end of his first year at the occupation centre, he was recorded as having disturbed behaviour, and there was a note saying, may have to be excluded. The hospital notes report my mother almost begging for him not to be excluded. And I wonder, looking back on it, what was the alternative for parents of such children in those days? What would happen when your child was excluded for their autistic behaviours? Were they just left with their families? What if their families couldn't provide care for them at home? How neglected were these children?
Clinics like Travancore under psychiatrist Dr. Keith Benn are expanding, but so is the number of psychotic children.
Because in fact, for a period of about 18 months, we've been taking in more and more and more emotionally disturbed children and admitting less and less and less.
In the 1960s, parents campaigned for access to education and turned their attention to what they felt was lacking, research into what the causes of autism might be and how their children's lives could be improved.
What would be the rate of recovery for autism?
Well, a lot of people have got different ideas about this.
I'm not qualified to say whether eventually he'll be back in normal society as a normal person.
After months of fundraising, the Autistic Children's Association of South Australia invited British psychiatrist Michael Rutter, today recognised as a leading figure in autism research, to be the keynote speaker at the first conference on autism in Australia. Close the door, light the light. Held in Adelaide in 1967, its theme was emblematic of the hopes of the time.
The title of the conference was Autism, Cure Tomorrow, Care Today. And that reflects, I think, what we and the other families of autistic children understood to be possible, and that is that with proper care there could be a cure. But they didn't know enough about it in those days. No one did. I remember that a couple of the volunteers who were helping with fundraising and organisation of that conference, one of them was a vegan, and he was really keen to propound veganism as a cure for autism. I recall another was a student. He was collecting the baby teeth of all known autistic children with a view to conducting a chemical analysis to find out what was the element that was missing in these children that that might be supplemented, thereby curing them.
As I read through the papers from that 1967 conference, there's one that, as a mother of two autistic boys myself, catches me off guard. The terms autism and psychosis are used interchangeably, which was common at the time. But there's something else in that particular paper that I want to show psychologist Laurie Bartak, who was involved in the first wave of autism research in Australia.
Here we are. It's the educational program at North Ryde.
Yeah, North Ryde Psychiatric Centre, suburban clinic, mental health clinic.
It was just this bit here that I've marked. Just have a little read of that paragraph.
One psychotic child with intractable head banging recently had a bilateral amygdalotomy performed with a most successful outcome, enabling staff to involve him in a re-education program. This is a highly selected procedure and we are as yet uncertain as to which children are suitable for this treatment.
I mean, I'm presuming that means some kind of lobotomy or brain surgery that she's talking about.
Oh, yes. The amygdala is a sort of deep brain structure that's concerned with integration of emotional information. Now, you've got a kid who's screaming or, in this case, headbanging. Now, I mean, headbanging is nasty and people detach their retinas if they do it a lot. But if you can reward them in appropriate, sensible ways for refraining from headbanging, they can learn to do it less. But you also need to know what's making them headbang, and it's often because they're over or under stimulated. For me, switching off a major chunk of their brain is not the answer.
Would that have been the type of thinking that might have underpinned some responses to autistic children in those early days?
Oh, yes. That's about the only time I've seen an amygdalectomy mentioned. It's a pretty horrific sort of thing to do, I think.
As the 1970s approached, the theory that mothers caused their children's autism was being replaced by a focus on possible biological causes. And it was British research published in 1971 that would help to debunk the refrigerator mother myth. British psychiatrist Michael Rutter led the research and was helped by a young Laurie Bartak, who was doing his doctorate in London at the time. The study compared two groups of parents. One group had autistic children, the other had children with what was termed other receptive language disorders.
We decided it was important to really have a serious look at the families and the family dynamics, as it were, interactions. So we looked at the parents' degrees of warmth towards different children in their family and to their spouse, and how obsessive they were and how anxious they were as well. But we looked at all the issues that had been said to be odd in parents of autistic children. Both groups of parents, as you might expect of parents of children with severe disabilities, were fairly anxious and stressed, but there was no difference between them. It really knocked that issue on the head. They long to be
close to you. But now that toxic parenting was being questioned in the research field, at least, did attitudes towards autism really change? Perhaps the ABC archives from the 1970s and 80s hold some clues.
This week, a special report prepared by Harry Martin, Living with David.
David Wareham is 17 years of age. He's a tall, gaunt, freckle-faced boy with reddish-coloured hair.
Jean Wareham and her son David featured in a radio program in 1973.
I think there have been people, perhaps, who haven't wanted to know us because we have David. There was a woman recently when we were in the city. She wanted to walk up the stairs and hold on when he was walking down, and he still finds it rather difficult to walk downstairs without hanging on. He had a certain rigidity in his leg, so that he's a little insecure. And she was a middle-aged or elderly woman, thought, considering he was a young person, he should have given way, apparently. And she stopped and quite actively abused him because he wouldn't get out of her way. And of course, he just looked at her, and then she said, "Oh, you're just dumb. That's the trouble with you, you know, you're just dumb."
Jean Wareham died in 1996, but I've got in touch with David's oldest brother, Neil. Does he remember the first time autism was mentioned in his family?
No, I don't, but I do remember that by the early to mid-1960s, he was in a local spastic and retarded children's centre. And I mean, I think going back in memory, we're sort of dealing with a situation where, to a significant degree, families are relatively on their own. The diagnoses, in some senses, were a bit uncertain. The level of care available, things like special schools, were few and far between, and the residential accommodation of the period was frankly awful.
Would you like a banana?
Mm.
Would you like some bread and butter?
Yes.
You'd like some bread and butter?
Yes.
Would you like to go and get it for yourself?
Yes.
You get the bread out. Get yourself a plate. Come on, run over there and get yourself. Oh, come on, Dave. Well, I'll get you a plate. Here you are.
We're going home by underground train.
Jean Wareham was also one of the first women in Victoria to be university trained in social work. So how was she affected by the pervasive view that mothers had somehow contributed to their children's autism? Her son, Neil.
I think she had a distrust of psychologists and psychiatrists, and there was a period of almost open warfare between social workers and psychologists about who could deal with what and in what fields. There was an element of hopeful thinking that if the right influences could be brought to bear, things might become better.
If you see an untreated autistic child, he's a disaster area. It is one of the most distressing handicaps because the children are intensely unhappy, not like this group. They are frantic with rage and frustration and grief and a whole...
That's Joan Curtis, another mother who was interviewed by ABC TV in 1980. She still lives in Mansfield in northeast Victoria, where she founded an autistic school and support service for her son Jonathan and other children.
Even though Humphrey and I are both doctors, we knew absolutely nothing about autism. We'd barely heard the word. I don't remember the explanation. It probably just passed over my head. What I do remember was the advice that I was given, which was take him home and love him, and when you can't manage him any longer, we'll put him into Kew Cottages.
Autistic children come in all kinds, and I wouldn't give any child up as being incapable of quite a considerable improvement in his ability to function. I don't mean by that his basic handicap...
Well, I wanted him to have as many life experiences as he could. You know, we were constantly introducing him to things. Got a trampoline and we got him a tricycle, and I wanted to get him to kindergarten. So everything had to be done in stages. When we started kindergarten, we would go down there when the place was empty and we'd just go into the playground and look round and come away again. And then we would go on a day when the kindergarten teacher was there doing some administrative work, but none of the children. Everything that we did with him had to be built up one brick at a time until we got where we wanted to be.
The long vacation. And in most of Victoria's secondary schools, the dust settles softly on empty corridors and classrooms. But not at Mansfield High School, which is the scene of a unique experiment.
I decided to run a camp. It was going to be a one-off thing. And the first year, I think we had about 12 families, and they lived at the high school. Some of them were in tents, some of them were in caravans, and some of them were sleeping in classrooms. And we had lots of lovely excursions. We went on the river, we went boats on Eildon, we went climbing mountains, and it was a very busy and very enjoyable time. And the interesting thing was that children who had been very resistant to change, their whole world had been turned upside down, and they responded extremely well to it. And it was a very positive experience for everybody. Anyway, that was the first camp. So it's our 50th year this year.
Ready, Anne. Couldn't sleep last night. Couldn't sleep last night.
And that's the sound of children enjoying the camp this year. You've been listening to part one of The Singular Mind, A History of Autism in Australia. The producer was Kathy Pryor and the sound engineer was Brendan O'Neill. And in our next program, we'll find out what life has been like for those children from the 1960s and 70s who are now adults. And we'll also hear how the definition, perceptions and attitudes towards autism have changed over the past half century. I'm Rebecca Huntley. You've been with The History Listen. Look forward to your company again next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.